find our peace and our happiness in You and our pleasure in You, that You would be the treasure of our day. Help us to grow in treasuring You so that we'll see that the land that we look forward to is one in which we are in Your presence forever, and that is our great reward. We pray that in the time that we're here on this earth that we would commit all of our works to the building up of Your kingdom, because we know that You take our works, that You add Your interest to it, and that great exploits take place when we do what we do in faith. We lift these things up to You in the name of Jesus. Amen. Daniel chapter 8. We're in the second chapter of the prophetic portion of the book of Daniel. And we have been in chapter 7. We were looking at a worldwide sort of global view. And I probably didn't do it very well because I think my brain was still muddled last week from all the virus and everything. So, I think I sort of rambled somewhat last week. But we're going to go streamlining through this one this week. I feel pretty sharp, so we'll see how we do. As we go through the book of through Daniel chapter 8, we're going to narrow down from the world view to a more specific impact that this kingdom of man we've been discussing has on the people of God, and that would be geographically in Palestine and in Judea, in Israel. And so we're going to gravitate towards that as we run through this chapter. Vision begins at the time of Belshazzar in his the third year of King Belshazzar's reign. Verse 1, Daniel says, "A vision appeared to me," and this is a waking vision. This is not one of those dream visions, but this is a waking vision. Basically, what it means is that a vision was imposed upon his sight. And he says, "I was in Susa," and he says this after he has said that the vision has been imposed upon him. And so there's some speculation that he was in Susa when he had the vision. But his being in Susa is part of the vision. He's probably in Babylon. There's really not a good reason to believe that Babylon would, Daniel would be in Susa. Susa was the capital fortress of the Medes. And we're still in the Babylonian period here. So there's not a real good reason why Daniel should be there. I wouldn't exclude that idea. But I think it's saying here that that in his vision he was in Susa. In other words, his vision is anticipating a shift in the power from Babylon to Susa. Susa is going to become the capital of the Medes. And so Daniel is, in his vision, in Susa. And he's looking over the Ulai Canal, which is a canal that connects two major tributary rivers together and supplies water to Susa. The canal ran outside of the fortress city. And so he's looking over this canal that's on the outside of the city, and he sees there a great ram. And that's not an unusual thing for him to see. Let me back up for just a second and say one more thing about verse 1. In the chapter 8 is in Hebrew, and it's in Hebrew for the first time since the middle of chapter 2. It's shifted over from the Syriac language. Now it's back in the Hebrew language again. And I think the reason for that is probably because of what we said earlier. We're about to gravitate towards the people of God, towards dealing with the people of God. Therefore, he's speaking more to the people of God here, and not to a worldwide audience particularly. Everything that's been happening up to this point, he's really dealing with this worldwide audience, so therefore he's speaking in the language of trade so that just anybody can understand. Now he's getting more particular in talking to his own people, and that would be in Hebrew. It's also Daniel talking, and he started this in chapter 7. Now he's continuing it. And he uses the idiom, me, I, Daniel, here, really emphasizing that he is the one who is speaking. So if there's any ideas about some Second Temple Maccabean Daniel who's writing the book in the second century, this pretty much excludes that for at least this section of the book of Daniel, because he's very emphatic about this, and this is not the words of a pretender. This is the words of the man who is writing the book. And not only is he saying emphatically, I am writing this, I saw this vision, but he's also describing some things in this area of Susa that a Second Temple Jew probably wouldn't have known about. They would have been ruins by that time, or at least he wouldn't have traveled that far. As we go into verse 3, we find that the center of this vision that he has is a ram. And that wouldn't be unusual in dealing with the Medes and the Persians, because the Persian kings often led their armies into battle wearing a headdress of a ram. The ram was as important to the Persians as the bull was to the Assyrians, and that's very important. It's the kind of the center of their symbols of strength and fertility and virility and all this kind of stuff. And so the ram is a very Persian symbol. This particular ram is it has two horns, and one of the horns is smaller than the other. The one that's larger comes afterwards and grows up and becomes larger than the smaller one. Now, let's back up for a minute and remember the images we've seen of this second kingdom so far. In Nebuchadnezzar's dream, this kingdom is shown as a silver chest with two arms. Then we see him in the last vision that we saw as a bear lifted up on one side. And now we see the vision of a ram with two horns, and they're uneven. All right, so there's always this dual nature and not equal, a dual but not equal nature, and that's really the nature of the Medes and the Persians in their dual monarchy. The Medes were the weaker partner. The Persians were the stronger partner and actually grew to the point to where they became totally dominant over the whole empire. That would be under Cyrus and Cambyses. He sees the ram, and we see in verse 20, and I'm going to go ahead and give you interpretive verses as we're going along just to save time. In verse 20, we see very clearly that this ram represents the Medes and the Persians and this empire. In verse 4, he says he sees the ram charging westward, northward, and southward. And this answers to the directions that the empire was expanding in. There isn't any significant expansion to the east. There are some holdings in India around the Indus River region, but it's not held. Greece comes along later and tries to take some of that area, and they fail as well. So really, India is the Khyber Pass region between what's today Pakistan and India is really the end of this empire. It has great difficulty going any further than that. The northern part of the empire, expanded by the Persians, was Babylon, Syria, and Asia Minor. The northern part, Armenia, and the Caspian Sea region. They actually engaged the Scythians in that region. And in the south, Egypt and Ethiopia are added to the empire. This makes this empire huge. It's much bigger than the Babylonians had. The Babylonians were controlling basically the Trans-Mediterranean region now that's been expanded out beyond the continent itself. In verse 5, a male goat appears, comes from the west. And in verse 21, we're going to see this is Greece. In verse 21, he interprets this goat as being the king of Javan. If you'll recall, Javan in the table of nations in Genesis 11 is one of the grandsons of Noah. son of Japheth, his name is cognate for the Eonians. Yawan would be the usage of the word in the Hebrew. And it's the Eonians, or the middle Greeks between the Peloponnese and Macedonia. The original settlement of the Greeks in the middle part of the Greek peninsula were the Eonians before the Dorians or Thracians came along and overlaid them. And these are the word Javan in Hebrew is just their term for the Greeks. And so this king of the Greeks, as it says in verse 21, is the goat, a male goat from the west. He comes across the face of the whole earth without touching the ground. We've already seen in the last chapter that speed is the significant aspect of this third kingdom. It's speed in conquest. And this is because the Greeks had learned a new way of warfare. Instead of massing up all of their people in huge hordes, each person having to take care of his own weaponry and train himself in the ways of war. He brings his whole family along with him, and they bring all of their stuff so that they can trade all over the world as they're going along. The Greeks didn't do that. They shed off all the baggage and got down to the raw soldiering and made sure that their men were streamlined, could move very quickly without all the encumbrances that former armies had used. And because they were able to do this, they were able to move fast. And the objective of the Greeks when they began the conquest of Persia was not so much to go around taking the outlying territories that belonged to the Persian Empire, but they went directly for Susa. That was their goal. They had to fight their way there, and they did, and fought very quickly, but their goal was to get to these main capital cities and to overcome them. Once they overcame them, the whole empire would fall to them. And so, using this strategy, they were able to take the empire very quickly. And so that would be basically this speed, this determination to go across the whole earth without touching the ground, and to have a real goal about where they were going and how they were going to go about doing it. I would say that, for the most part, the Babylonians and the Persians, acquisition of empire and of nations before this is somewhat haphazard. There are certain motions that are going on in the world that cause them to react and begin to take over nations. Greece is not like that. Greece has a very strong strategy and a very determined strategy, and they go for it. A horn is in between the eyes of this goat. And this horn represents, as we see in verse 22, or in verse 21, the first king of the Greeks. And make sure you keep this in context. It's not the first king of all Greeks. It's the first king of the Greeks to rule this empire. And that's clearly going to be the very one who conquered the Persian Empire, Alexander the Great. This was recognized by the Jewish people in the 2nd century B.C., very much recognized by them, and it passed into a story which I'm not sure whether this is true or not, or whether it's part of their legend, that they actually met Alexander the Great outside of the walls of the city and showed him in the book of Daniel that he was this little horn. And he was so grateful of knowing that God had paid attention to him and prophecy and everything that he ordered the translation of the Bible into Greek, or what we now call the Septuagint. I don't know whether that's true or not, but the main thing is that it's a very old story among the Jews, which means that the Jews, from all the way back into the 2nd century, into the Greek period of time, recognized Alexander the Great, and they recognized this process of transfer of kingdoms taking place between the testamental periods of time. Okay? And to me, that's the most important part of this whole thing, is to make sure we understood that the Jews understood this process that was taking place in the book of Daniel leading up to the coming of Messiah. So they're not blind. They're not blind as they're running through this period. They do understand how this process is going. And they are tracking these prophecies and the events in the world that are leading up to the coming of Messiah. An encounter takes place in verse 6 between the goat and the ram. I want you to note something. Back in verse 4, we have a description of the ram saying there was no beast who could stand before this ram. No one could rescue him. No one who could rescue from his power. Putting that in context, Daniel is seeing this vision in the third year of Belshazzar. Okay, Babylon is this close to its end. It's about to be wrapped up. It's about to be overrun by the Medes and Persians. In other words, Babylon has run out of power. And the magisterium is about to be transferred over to the Medes and the Persians. And we're on the very threshold of this as Daniel is seeing this vision. And he sees this ram as this great powerhouse coming in. And nothing can stand in its way. And it's got all this power vested to it. And whatever it wants to do, it can do. And then in verse 7, the description of the ram is, the ram had no power, and there was no one who could rescue the ram. Almost exactly the same language that we saw in verse 4, referring to all of the other nations that were unable to stand before the ram. Now the ram is without power. The ram is now about to lose its magisterium to the Greeks. And the Greeks now possess that power. What we're seeing is a continual transfer of power from one group to another in this kingdom of man. And you'll notice this too as you run through this chapter. It'll say, the ram was great, and the goat grew great, and the horn was great. And the little horn was great, and he got greater, and then he was very great. What we're seeing here is this power, this magisterium, this ability to make the laws and rule, this ability to digest the kingdoms that have been conquered and so forth. It's not something that's welling up from inside of these people. It's something that's laid upon them. It's something that's given to them. In other words, they are assigned this power and are decreed the ability to rule. By whom? By God. God is giving them the power. God is giving them the greatness. You have to see it this way. There isn't anything humanistic about this chapter. We don't see the circumstances and the natural abilities of these people coming to the fore. What we see is power being vested to them by God. God is in control of the goat and of the horn and of everything. And that's what's most important about everything that we're seeing here. Well, the goat runs at the ram in his powerful wrath. And he was enraged in verse 7 against him, and he struck the ram and broke his two horns. What we're seeing here is something a little different from the development of the kingdom up to this point. Babylon and the Persians have taken over this great kingdom. They're Asians. They're kinfolk. It had been a family squabble up to this point. Greece is different. They're European, and they are very foreign. They're not a part of this Middle East Asian family who very much recognize themselves as kinfolk. The Greeks are quite different. They're outsiders to the nth degree, the islands of the sea, so to speak. And what's going to happen here is that as as they come in, they come in with a, as the King James Version says, with a collar, a cholera, an anger, an ox. They've got an issue with Persia, and that's the reasoning behind their drive to take over the Persian Empire. They're mad. They have hatred and bitterness against Persia. If you know anything about the Greek history, just a little bit about Greek history, you'll know why. Darius the Persian attacked Greece sometime earlier, decimated a good deal of its countryside, caused a great deal of destruction with the Greeks after having done trade with them. It was a duplicitous encounter that he had with the Greeks, and the Greeks fought it off bravely, and they lost a lot of people, and they had a lot of their territory, buildings, crops, things like that, destroyed by the Persians as they were coming through. They really got an attitude about the Persians after a while, and by the time Philip of Macedon had united the Greeks together, and then Alexander came along with his ambitions, he had one thing in mind, and all the Greeks did, and that was, we're going to get the Persians back for what they did. And in getting the Persians back, they get the empire. I mean, that's the reward for the whole thing. And so, yes, they do have a deep bitterness against the Persians, and that is their driving force that causes them to move through conquest. this horn... who is Alexander the Great, he becomes exceedingly great. His power is increased by his conquest. And when he's at his height, when he's still strong, he's not going into a weakness, the horn was broken. This is a reference to Alexander the Great's early death. He was about 28 years old when he died. He was still building this empire. He had not finished yet. Putting it together, organizing it. There was no weakness in the empire at all. He just simply died. There's a lot of speculation about why he died. There are even doctors who think they diagnosed how he died. That's pretty interesting, you know, to be able to diagnose about a 2,300-year-old disease. More than likely, he succumbed to the wounds that he got when he was trying to take over India, and he was wounded badly there, and he probably just gave in to them, but nobody really knows. We do know one thing, God was finished with him. And when he died, instead of bequeathing the entire empire over to one king, the empire was divided among five of his generals. One of them was bumped off real quickly, so it came down to four quickly. Antigonus, I believe it was, who was knocked out of it. Cassander, Lysimachus, Seleucus, and Ptolemy. Those were the four generals that the empire was divided among. And Cassander was the Macedonian king, so he basically was in control of the Greek area. Lysimachus was in control of Thrace in Asia Minor, Seleucus of Syria, and Ptolemy of Egypt and Ethiopia. And these would be the kings that this horn has broken into in the four winds of the heavens, north, south, east, and west. All right. Out of these kings, verse 9, out of them, it says a little horn would appear. Probably a better way of saying that would be, went forth one horn from littleness. And I'll get back to that in just a minute. Them. Verse 23 interprets this part of verse 9 and says, and at the latter end of theirs, the Greeks' kingdom, this king would appear, this particular king, this little horn that we're going to deal with in just a minute. And also, this would take place when the transgressors have reached their limit. This is a phrase of language that's used frequently in the Scriptures. I think the first time you run across it is probably in Genesis 17, where God basically is saying when the time of the Amorites' iniquity has come to its fullness, or when it has come to the boil. God waits upon an iniquity until it reaches a certain level before action is taken place. The word transgressor is very important here too. It means rebel. So we're dealing with insiders here, people who are rebelling against their rightful authorities. I believe the transgressors we're talking about here are apostate Jews. And we'll get into that more when we get into chapter 11. Chapter 11 is going to take everything we're talking about right here and really take it to some real detail right at this period right here. And this is at the period of the little horn. Okay. All right, so these two things have to happen. The Greeks are coming to their end, right? And secondly, these apostate Jews are beginning to boil up. And right at that point, this little horn appears. And this little horn represents a Greek Seleucid king by the name of Antiochus Epiphanes. And Antiochus Epiphanes is in we're really going to go into Antiochus in great detail in chapter 11, because chapter 11 has a lot to say about him and a couple of the other Seleucid kings. Before I go on and talk about him, why would he mention Antiochus Epiphanes here? And this is important in interpreting the book of Daniel, because a lot of people want to take this little horn and translate him over as some future Antichrist, when he sits very nicely and solidly in this second kingdom and is inseparable from it. But why would this be so important for him to deal with Antiochus Epiphanes? And why is it so important to leave this little horn in the Greek kingdom and not pull it out and throw it into the future or do any other kind of strange acrobatics with theology here would be basically what it would come down to. Well, the reason I believe is this. Remember, over and over again, we find Daniel at the beginning in the third year of Belshazzar, the end of the Babylonians. We see him marking the end of the Persian period. And now he's marking the end of the Greek. He's marking the end of the Greek period. And this is Antiochus. He's already said this king will come up at the end of the Greek period. So he's being marked by Antiochus. But not just that. But Antiochus is, his power, his magisterium, is being shared not with all the other Greeks, but with the Romans. The Romans are on the scene right now at this point. You don't see them in the text. And, we don't need to worry about that either. We know they're going to take over. But they're already there. If you read and study the career of Antiochus Epiphanes, and we'll talk about this more later, you're going to find out not only did he come from the Romans, but he was empowered by the Romans. The Romans are already beginning to slide into this picture. We see another transition between magisterium here. And that's very important to understanding this chapter. That's why Antiochus is important here too. Antiochus, verse 23, is a king bold of face, one who understands rhythm. Riddles. He was a good musician, too. I understand. Now, that was Nero, I'm sorry. Who understands riddles. Basically, what this is talking about, and this comes out in verse 25 as well, and as you study Antiochus, you'll find out that the way that he rose up and became the king, the great king that he became, was through his mastery of duplicity and diplomacy. He was a trickster, a deceiver. He deceived the people who were under him. He deceived the surrounding kings. He would bring them to a diplomatic table. They would discuss diplomacy and so forth. He was never going to be true to it. He was simply just setting them up for a fall. And we're going to see that when we get into chapter 11, that this is basically the way he's going to take over Egypt, is by this kind of duplicity. verse 25 is a better description. By his cunning he shall make deceit prosper under his hand, and in his own mind he shall become great. We said that out of them, verse 9, went forth one horn from littleness. I don't know what your translation says, but this is probably a better way of looking at it's probably a more apt description of how he grew up from small beginnings and became a great king. Antiochus actually was he was actually a hostage of Rome. When Antiochus the Great died, he was actually a Roman hostage. He had no power whatsoever, and when he went into the Holy Land, or when he was trying to take over Syria, he had to weasel his way through it. I'm going to have a lot more to say about him later, so I'll leave off for now. Verse 9 through 11, I think I've already brought this out. He grew great. Verse 10, he grew great. Verse 11, it became great. He's just getting, in his own mind, he's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And in his power, too. There's no doubt about that. Verse 24 says, his greatness that he grew was not by his own power. And this refers to his backing and his alliance with Rome, I believe. And at the height of all this, he actually begins war with the south. And this is Ptolemy's kingdom that he begins war with. Antiochus had several incursions into Egypt. Actually, had two major incursions into Egypt, and actually wound up conquering it. According to 1 Maccabees, he entered into Egypt with a great host, and he took the spoils of Egypt. He also spreads out the Syrian part of the Seleucid kingdom out towards the east, Elymais and Armenia, and also he has possession of the Holy Land itself, the land of desire, the glorious land, according to verse 9. I believe probably a good translation would be the desire. The desire comes from Jeremiah 3:19, and it refers to Israel. And then in verse 10, he grows even in his greatness even to the host of heaven. Here, I think we see him actually beginning warfare with God's people for the purpose of destroying God's people because they are God's people. And I think that's very significant in how we've dealt with Daniel up to this point. We've seen this kingdom of man growing and growing. The concentration of the kingdom of man into this single image, or in the succession of beasts, or however you want to look at it. And ultimately, what they're going to do is they're going to attack God's people. Remember Cain and Abel. We're going back to that again. That's why we have these horns on the ends of these beasts. Not so that we can break the horns off and dissect them, but to see that these horns are empowered by the entire beast, by the whole kingdom itself. What we see here is the point of contact with God's people and this war that's going to take place against God and His kingdom by the kingdom of man. Even to the point to where he will, in verse 11, act greatly unto the prince of the host himself. So much so that the regular burnt offerings would be taken away under Antiochus, and the place of the sanctuary would be overthrown. Let me read to you from Josephus real quickly. Yeah. This would be from the Antiquities. And there would arise from their number a certain king who would make war on the Jewish nation in their laws, deprive them of the form of government based on these laws, spoil the temple, prevent the sacrifices from being offered for 3 years, and these misfortunes our nation did in fact come to experience under Antiochus Epiphanes, just as Daniel many years before saw and wrote that it would happen. In 1 Maccabees 1:44-47, and the king sent letters by the hand of messengers unto Jerusalem and the cities of Judah, that they should follow laws strange to the land, and should forbid whole burnt offerings and sacrifice and drink offerings in the sanctuary, and should profane the Sabbath and feasts, and pollute the sanctuary and them that were holy. Understand two things. Number one, this did happen, and not only that, but the Jewish people at that time understood that its happening was an answer to this prophecy. Okay. There's a lot of unanswered stuff going on here, but I'm going to get back to this when we get into chapter 11. What would be the duration of this time? Verse 13. A holy one comes along speaking, and then another one says to him, how long is this vision going to take place? For 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the sanctuary shall be restored to its rightful state. There's some speculation that this 2,300 evenings and mornings should be split in half into 1,150, so that it'll make 3.5 years, which fits in nicely with with kind of the first part of some tribulation period in the future and all that kind of junk. Forget that. 2,300 years is 2,300 evenings and morning is 2,300 evenings and morning. Whenever you have evenings and morning put together in Hebrew, it's basically talking about a day. All right? So it's 2,300 days. Whether this is supposed to be absolutely accurate or not, I wouldn't go with that. Prophetic language is not. It rounds things out really nicely. However, interestingly enough, 2,300 days comes to about 6 years and 3 to 4 months, which would be about to answer up pretty nicely to the period of 171 to 165 B.C., the time that Antiochus Epiphanes is leaving Egypt to attack the Holy Land, because to put down a rebellion that's going on there, to the time he dies, which would be the end of the Jewish war. About 6 years, 3-4 months, somewhere around 2,300 days. All right, so it works out very nicely if you just leave the numbers alone. And I think that's probably what's being referred to here. That whole period where Antiochus is really messing with Israel. The Maccabean Revolution comes out of this period of time, and to me, one of the most interesting things that happens is that the apostate Jews, who are Hellenists, they are a group of Jews, actually a movement of Jews in the 2nd and 3rd century B.C., who actually were adopting Greek ways, Greek philosophy. They were called Hellenists. It got so intense that they actually built a gymnasium right in front of the temple in Jerusalem, and were holding Olympic games in this gymnasium. And we'll talk about them more when we get into chapter 11 too. But this movement of the Hellenists was so intense and so much threatened to completely destroy the Jewish religion, that after the Maccabean Revolution, there was an imposition of extremely conservative religion upon Israel. This would be what we see here as the cleansing of the temple after the desecration of it by Antiochus. So much so that schools began to grow up to hedge this new conservatism that was beginning in the middle part of the second century among the Jews. And one of the leading groups to come out of this would be the Pharisees. And the Pharisees began to put together traditions to hedge the Jewish people against non-Jewish people. And that's going to be the center of their creation of traditions that they're going to attribute to Moses later on. It starts right here at this period. This the creation of that faction that's going to be Jesus' biggest enemy comes out of this period of time. All right. We dealt with the interpretation. Gabriel is sent to give this interpretation, and I think we incorporated that in with the rest of what we were doing. But Gabriel ends this up, verse 17 through 19, by saying this vision is for the time of the end. It is for the latter end of the indignations. It refers to the appointed time of the end. This is where the premillennialists go hog wild. This is definitely has to do with the end. Well, you know, the whole context has been in the second century B.C., and suddenly it's for the end. Does it make any sense? The end in the latter days is used frequently through the Bible to refer to the end of an era, a prescribed era that's been set forth by God. And that's what he's talking about here. There are two ends we're going to see in the book of Daniel. One of them is this one right here, which is very specifically pointing to the end of the Greek period. That's the end. And I don't think there's any doubt about this either. It's been reiterated throughout the chapter up to this point. Later on, when we get into chapter 12, we're going to see another end. And that's going to be the end of the entire era. That is the end of that prescribed period of time in which these visions, all of the visions of the book of Daniel, are dealing with. And when we get to the end of that period, we're in the latter days. Another way to put it would be at the end of the Old Covenant period. The Old Covenant is going to end with a bang. And when it ends, that's its latter days. If you want to put it in perspective, the latter days is going to basically be the period of the apostles, the apostolic period, all right, for the most part. But if he gives a prescription and says specifically, this is the latter time right here, that's it. We don't have to go all the way to the end of time. We can just stay right in that period of time, and things are not confusing when we do so. Then he tells him in verse 26, seal up the vision. Seal up the vision. I'll get into that in chapter 12 because there is a sealing of this prophecy that takes place, and then there's an unsealing of it that takes place in the New Testament. We find Daniel sick by this vision in verse 27. Don't worry about Daniel, because when we get into chapter 10, God's going to give him a lot of comfort. And we'll go back and gather Daniel together again here and put his pieces back together. You've got to understand, Daniel must have been very stressed out by all of this stuff. And he says so himself. I'm sick for days. I'm appalled by this whole thing. I see the restoration of Israel being set up, and then all of a sudden, what does he see? He sees these nations coming through and desecrating the temple and doing all kinds of terrible things. And it's an awful thing for Daniel to have to look at all of this history in advance. This whole vision targets the period when Roman hegemony is beginning to bring about the transfer of the magisterium that we've been seeing from the Greeks to the Romans. And that's where this thing has headed ever since the beginning of the chapter. The Persians were irresistible in the beginning, but they were made powerless by the Greeks. And now we're on the eve of the Greek impotence in the presence of Roman conquest. The Romans already at this period of time have made headway in Rhodes and in Macedonia. There's a movement in Judah towards Hellenization, and the strength of it is so great that the powerful leaders in Judah are replacing the Old Testament law for the laws based on Greek philosophy and culture. The high priest's office is bought and sold by the king, the Greek king. Very lowly men are occupying this office, men who often lack any Levitical qualifications whatsoever. Two things come out of this period. I'm going to leave you this. One is the Maccabean Revolution, and that is going to be a time of the cleansing of the temple. And two is that a reaction takes place out of this against the Hellenists from the conservative Jews. The latter is the most important of these. The movement will center on a hedge between Jews and Gentiles so powerful that it will become the focal point of an evolving tradition. and the members of this movement will become the Pharisees. Let's end in prayer. Father, we thank you that you have revealed these things to us. The seal is now broken, and that we are able to see these things. Help us to understand how important they are to us now, that we know that our Messiah, that our Christ sits solidly in the history of redemption. Help us not to confuse the issue and muddy the waters by taking things out of their place, but to hold things where they are and to see you, the establishment of your kingdom, knowing that your kingdom is still operating and growing today, and that it will go on doing so to the end of time. We pray these things in the name of Jesus.